We've been teaching on the Bermuda Triangle, but not just randomly. There are things that interconnect. The Pyramid, Stonehenge, Atlantis, Bermuda Triangle, the world before the flood, those beings that came down and mated with the women of the earth, if Genesis is correct. All of these things interconnect, and demonology. We just touched on demonology last night. But I had also left the Bermuda Triangle for a little while to point out that on the other side of the Atlantic, at the 35th parallel in the Azores, there are some strange things that happen also. I kidded you. Then I said, whatever it is, it has a different kind of appetite in the Azores. And we stopped with a but. On November 1872, the brigantine Mary Celeste left New York for Genoa with a crew of 12 aboard. On December 2nd, it was seen... None of you believe I'd do this tonight. But we'll see, won't we? On December 2nd, it was seen off the coast of Europe, apparently proceeding normally on its way. Now, I'm going to tell you something. On Friday nights, there's a certain point where the numbness leaves your bones and life flows back into you, if you just have a little faith. I mean, it's Friday night. The centers are just getting started right now on the West Coast. What are you, a bunch of moist pellets? Or are you a flower on top of a tree? Now, I'm going to scan you rather closely, see which you resemble. A flower on the top of a tree, or a moist pellet shoved into another moist pellet. I ain't teaching no bunch of fungi tonight. On December 2nd, it was seen off the coast of Europe, apparently proceeding normally on its way. On December 4th, it was sighted by the British ship De Gracia. The Mary Celeste was sailing briskly before the wind. Now, you know why I'm doing this, don't you? I want you to understand that some strange things go on in the Bermuda Triangle, but also on the other side, off the coast of Portugal, near the Azores. Got it? The Mary Celeste was sailing briskly before the wind, but... Now, over here in this, the Mary Celeste was sailing briskly before the wind, but the captain, of the De Gracia was surprised to receive no answer to his signals. Moving closer, the British crewman saw that there was no one at the helm or on deck. And one of them said jokingly, "Here's a ghost ship at last." His words were truer than he knew. For when some of the British sailors rowed to the Mary Celeste and boarded it, they found it completely empty. And yet, except for the heavy silence, there was nothing to give the impression that a tragedy had occurred. I'm reading from Forgotten Worlds by Robert Charroux. There was nothing to give the impression that a tragedy had occurred. Everything was in order. Breakfast was on the table. The deck had been washed. The lines were correctly coiled. The lifeboat was in its davits in perfect condition. Recently washed clothes had been hung out to dry. There was plenty of food in the storeroom. The British sailors searched the ship from stem to stern without finding a living soul. This was the first time, within memory, that such a thing had ever happened at sea. There seemed to be no possible explanation. The Atlantic is always rather rough near the Azores at that time of year, but there had been neither a storm nor unusually high waves, and a two-masted brigantine with a crew of 12 would have been able to cope with almost any kind of weather. It may not be quite true to say that there was not a living soul aboard the Mary Celeste. A placid gray cat was found. Disturbingly, sailors regard their pets as bringing them good luck and always try to save them even if they abandon ship. There was no solution to the enigma. If the crew members had been forced to leave the ship, they would have used the lifeboat. If there had been a mutiny, signs of struggle or disorder would have been found. If a storm had endangered the ship, it would have been damaged and the sails would have been taken in. The British sailors made one discovery that might be regarded as a clue, although it served only to direct their conjectures into the realm of the unknown. In the ship's log, the captain of the Mary Celeste had noted only routine details, such as weather conditions, until the last sentence, which was unfinished and contained these cryptic words, quote, "A strange thing is happening to us." Now, there's several other illustrations that I can give you, but I said the appetite is different. In the Bermuda Triangle, thousands of ships and airplanes and passengers have disappeared. Around the Azores, people disappear off the ships and they're left vacant. I'll give you a sample of several, but I've got to leave Dallas right now. Let me just say, so I don't leave you hanging, which is something I never want to do. People disappear around the Azores and the ships are just floating empty. Everything disappears around the Bermuda Triangle. Now, every kind of explanation has been offered, from UFO base to a sunken power source that was on Atlantis to demons. I want to look at everything, keep our mind open. And I've been wanting to get on the subject of demonology for some time, unless you think I'm going to get with those funny ones that spit them out on napkins and talk backwards in records. If that's all the demons we've got to deal with, I ain't worried, friend. I never touched spit, and I've never played a record backwards. So he's wasting his effort on me. I'm going to start with a Catholic demonologist, the one that was called in on the Amityville Horror, and we left him last night with a demon approaching. I'm reading from the book The Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren by Gerald Brittle. Now, you all can slip back. You can read in the Gospels if you want. Just start in Mark's Gospel, the short one. Everywhere Jesus goes, says he runs into devils. The Greek word, daimons, lieutenants of the devil. Only one devil, Diabolus, from which we get our Latin and Spanish words for devil. Demons. Finds one in the synagogue, possessing a person that was worshiping there. Paul cast one out of that girl that was praising him. Jesus comes upon the demoniac boy of the Gadarenes. Those demons were acting on him. He broke chains and terrorized the village. They talked back through him to Jesus, said, "Our name's Legion." They didn't want to go into the pit, the deep, the abyss. They begged to be put in pigs. The pigs ran right in the water. You can't accept the New Testament and the Old Testament without believing in supernatural demoniac forces. Job is a poor little old pawn on the chessboard down there for a contest suggested by the devil. And he still has access, the devil does, when the sons of God, as they're called in Job, appear before God. That ought to be your clue to who it was came down, had the affair with the women on earth in Genesis. Now, he still has access. He's the accuser of the brethren. But we have an advocate. I mean, who do you think Jesus is arguing with? God? That's a nonsense position. He isn't arguing with God. God's the love of the world, sent his son. He isn't arguing with the rest of heaven. He's arguing with the accuser of the brethren, who still has access and will until God in the book of Revelation turns him loose, turns Michael loose, to cast him out of the heavens and then look out earth, because his territory has been diminished and he's full of hate, and that's his last stand. Out of the abyss will be released scorpion demons to bring pain on the earth. 200 million are chained, waiting their release during the tribulation in and around the area of the Euphrates, which tells you why there's so much cruelty and evil there. In the book of Daniel, Daniel prayed. The angel that came took 3 weeks to bring the answer, because he was fighting the demon that ruled, the real ruler, that ruled through the human instruments in Persia. When Moses died, Michael wrestled with Satan for the body of Moses. Now, either it's all a bunch of crap, or there are some very real forces out there. And Paul said to the church, warning them, we can't make it without the power of the Spirit. That's why the church that tries to rubber stamp works of righteousness on you produces an impoverished, hypocritical, failure church. You can't make it against Satan without the power of the Spirit. Greater is he that's in us than he that's in the world. The power of the Spirit comes to men and women of faith, and we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Well, now that isn't exclusive to Christianity. Pentecostal and charismatic. You talk on demons, Satan loves to have everybody think that puts you on the funny fringe. Then he can go about doing his work, and intelligent people never believe in those things. I would like to have a tight hold on the nape of the neck of some ivory-towered professors I've known, and make them sit with me at a spiritist meeting, or a spiritualist meeting in Brazil. Not the tourist one, the real one. Or watch a shaman perform. Or a Haitian witch doctor. Or a witch doctor in clear up past those rice terraces, way up in the still head-hunting tribes of northern Luzon. But I don't want to start with those. Here's a respected demonologist. Beyond Amityville, the first chapter says. Everybody knows about the Amityville horror. Outside Ed Warren's office in Fairfield County, can I read this part again? Try and stop me. This is where I find out if you are a moist pellet or a flower on a tree. If you're a moist pellet, you can count on the fact I will come to the same place and stop. If you're a flower on a tree, I just might continue. Outside Ed Warren's office, in Fairfield County, an old chapel clock ticked away the passing moments with quiet, mechanical precision. All else stood still. It was the middle of a cold, dark night in New England. Inside the office, a brass lamp lit the desk where Ed Warren, a pensive, gray-haired man of 50, sat working. Hundreds of books surrounded him, most bearing strange, arcane titles on the mysterious lore of demonology. Above the desk hung photographs of monks and grim-faced exorcists standing with Ed Warren in abbey-like settings. For Ed, working in the still silence of the night, it had been a wicked day, one that was not yet over. Just before the hour, the clock movement came alive in a series of clicks and relays, finally churning up three somber, resonating bombs. At the third stroke, Ed looked up, listened into the darkness, then went back to writing. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, the true witching hour, the hour of the Antichrist. And now, unbeknownst to him, Ed Warren was on borrowed time. Only hours before, Ed and Lorraine Warren had returned to their home in Connecticut after having been called in to investigate claims of a haunted house on Long Island's South Shore in a pleasant residential suburb of New York City. In December 1975, the house had been purchased by George and Kathleen Lutz, who moved into it about Christmas of that year with their three young children. A year before the Lutzes bought the house, the eldest son of the previous owner murdered the 6 sleeping members of his family at 3:15 in the morning of November 13, 1974, with a 35 caliber rifle. On January 15, 1976, the Lutzes fled from the house, contending that they had been victimized by manifest supernatural forces. It was a case that later came to be known as the Amityville Horror. By the end of January 1976, the press had become fully aware of the Lutz family's claim of a bizarre experience in the house and promptly called experts into the case. The experts brought in were Ed and Lorraine Warren. The Warrens were consulted because in professional circles, they are considered to be perhaps this country's leading authorities on the subject of spirits and supernatural phenomena. Over the course of some 3 decades, Ed and Lorraine Warren have investigated over 3,000 paranormal and supernatural disturbances. The question the news media had essentially wanted answered was whether there was a ghost in the house at that time. The answer the Warrens gave at the end of their 3-day investigation, however, was something no one had bargained for. Yes, the Warrens disclosed at the time, in our judgment, there was a spirit that had plagued the Lutzes in the house. But they also concluded no ghost was present. What did this paradoxical statement mean? Did this imply there were other kinds of spirits than ghosts? The answer the Warrens gave was yes. There are 2 types of spirits that are encountered in true haunting situations, the Warrens explained on March 6, 1976. One is human. The other, however, is inhuman. An inhuman spirit is something that has never walked the earth in human form before. Now you may say, "Well, what are you doing? Trying to play a Halloween joke?" No, I'm just reading a book. But you believe the Bible, and I'm going to reference the same thing I did last night. Saul went to see a witch at Endor. Scripture says she brought forth the spirit of Samuel. And Samuel began to talk. Now, you'll never prove which is which. Depending upon your a priori theological position, you must conclude either this witch brought forth the spirit of Samuel, which by Ed Williams' discussion would be ghost, or this witch brought forth a spirit that took the form of Samuel and claimed to be Samuel and fooled Saul and everybody that has the other theological position. Your a priori position from other scriptural positions will determine your interpretation. The text itself allows either. Now, the point is that Ed Warren is making, in a haunted situation you will encounter spirits that appear to be or represent themselves to be spirits of departed human beings. Or you will encounter inhuman supernatural substances that make no claim nor give any impression of being former human beings. That's the point he's making. The Warren's sobering information was not merely well-intentioned speculation, because fully 2 weeks before this event, Ed and Lorraine Warren had been confronted by an inhuman spirit in their own home. The visitation happened to Ed first. Here we go. Not boring you? Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building attached to the main house by a long enclosed passageway. You got the picture? Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building attached to the main house by a long enclosed passageway. Got it? As Ed sat working on preliminary details of the Amityville case that fateful February morning, the latch at the end of the passageway snapped open, followed by the percussive boom of the heavy wooden door. Footsteps then started toward the office. Ed leaned back in his chair, waiting for Lorraine to enter with a much-needed cup of coffee. In here, Ed Warren called out. Long moments passed, and she did not appear. Lorraine! Ed called out again, but there was no reply. What he heard instead, building in the distance, was an eerie, howling wind. It was not the whistling of wind under the eaves, but rather the menacing roar of a distant cyclone. Goose flesh rose on his arms. Lorraine, he cried forcefully. Are you there? Still, there was no response. As the ominous, swirling sound built in power and intensity. Shut up over there. I can do this for myself. Ed quickly thought back over the last few minutes. It then occurred to him that he had heard only 3 footsteps in the passageway, not the continuous tread of a person walking. Something was wrong. Suddenly, do I continue?
Yes, sir.
Suddenly, do I continue slowly or fast? Suddenly, the desk lamp dimmed to the strength of a candle flame. Now, occasionally I joke with you. This ain't no joke. Suddenly the desk lamp dimmed to the strength of a candle flame. Then, abruptly, the temperature in the office plunged to that of a walk-in freezer. a rank, pungent smell of sulfur rose in the room. Suspicious of the unnatural clamor, Ed Warren opened a desk drawer and withdrew a vial of holy water and a large wooden crucifix. Now, as I told you last night, you could be an Orthodox Jew, and you sit in this room, and this happened in the corridor outside your little cottage, I'll bet you would pick up a Book of Mormon if it had been left on your table. Suspicious of the unnatural clamor, Ed Warren opened a desk drawer and withdrew a vial of holy water and a large wooden crucifix. He then got up and walked a few steps out of his office into the anteroom. As he did, there swirled out of the passageway a horrendous, conical whirlwind. Pointed at the bottom, broad at the top, the thing was blacker than the natural blackness of night. Got another black mass. Four larger than a man, the swirling black mass moved into the dimly lit room and drifted slowly to Ed's left side. Came to a halt some 10 feet away. As Ed watched, that's courage. As Ed watched, it appeared to grow even denser and blacker than it was before. Indeed, within the swirl, he could see that something was beginning to take shape. An entity was beginning to manifest in physical form. As a demonologist, Ed Warren knew he had to act quickly, to take the initiative, before this fearsome black mass transformed itself into something even more forbidding and dangerous. Holding the cross toward what was now rapidly changing into a macabre hooded specter, Ed Warren stepped forward. The moment he did, however, and that's where we were last night, the moment he did, however, the moment he did, however, now as your faith is, so may it happen unto you. You that think I'm not going to continue, how dare you suspect my pure motives? The moment he did, however, the entity moved defiantly toward him. Ed stopped. The moment he did, however, the entity moved defiantly toward him. Now, what would you do? Ed stopped and stood his ground as the form slowly drifted forward. When the swirling black mass was no more than a few feet away, Ed methodically and with absolute determination showered the thing in the sign of the cross with the contents of the holy water vial. Now, I repeat, I don't think there's any power in the cross, that little crucifix, or the holy water. What's going to happen next? The important point is that it became a foci of faith for Ed Warren. It's his next words that make the difference. The cross, the crucifix, he could walk right through that, Satan that is. The holy water, I have an idea. If I was holding one of those Jerusalem rocks, I'd throw it at him. I mean, use every weapon you got, my friend. I mean, in that kind of circumstance, it's like sometimes I sit down to eat and cross myself once a week just in case I'm wrong. I mean, grab every weapon you got. But don't forget to fire the cannon. He showered the holy water vial on him. I hope he didn't pay some evangelist $100 for it. Then he spoke the ancient command, and this is the canon. In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave. He could have waved the Mormon Bible at him, and that command would still be the canon. For eternal seconds, the black mass stayed motionless, no more than a foot away. Then, you know, you got to hand it to this old boy. I say courage is 90% of faith. Then, slowly, it began to back off, though not before giving Ed a clear vision of himself and Lorraine involved in a potentially deadly automobile accident along a highway. Throw in that bitter pill. With that, the entity withdrew into the passageway from whence it came. An enormous sense of relief came over Ed Warren as he stood sweating profusely in the freezing cold room. Yet, as he attempted to collect his thoughts, the vicious snarl of fighting animals suddenly erupted outside the house. Immediately, Ed realized there were no animals fighting. The visitation was still in progress. The entity had simply moved upstairs to attack Lorraine. Avoiding the passageway, Ed flung open the side door to the office and ran up the back steps of the house. He would be too late. Upstairs. You want to hear the rest? Pamper me. Avoiding the passageway, Ed flung open the side door to the office and ran up the back steps of the house. He would be too late. Upstairs. Let's see what they have to say at home. For all I know, the only people that's here is us. Maybe everybody's at home, sleep, don't care about any of this. I tell you what the devil wants. He wants nobody to believe he exists until he's got you where he wants you. This number is 1-800-338-3030. Unless they're at home and vitally interested, and promise me on the blood of their children they'll be in the King's house Sunday. Get on the phone and talk to me. I want to know whether I got an audience before I go another inch with this black swirl. And I will tell you some ghost stories. But I want you to know that what I'm doing now just might not be a ghost story. Now, we've been talking about the Bermuda Triangle, haven't we? I've been making only one point. Strange things happen in and around the Bermuda Triangle. Planes disappear with their crew. Ships disappear. Harry Marshall, the Greek industrialist, goes under the water to photograph, discovers a pyramid with things sucking in and opening at the top and blowing them out at the bottom. bigger than the one in Egypt. Dr. Valentine discovers those walls and causeways near Bimini. Same year that Edgar Casey said things like that would happen. Edgar Casey goes to sleep and talks in his sleep, and people write it down. They call it readings. And he hit a lot of things. You can write them off if you want. I don't. Nostradamus is not to be written off. It's to be explained, if you can. Dr. Brown, and then that mayor candidate of Orlando, discovering pyramids underwater. Flight 19, five torpedo bombers and a Mariner search plane disappear without a trace. Have I read enough about the Bermuda Triangle for you to get the point? Strange things happen in and around the Bermuda Triangle. Now, the pyramid's there. Is that the edge of the ancient Atlantis? Did Atlantis exist that Plato talked about? That in one great terrible day and night sank beneath the sea. Now they've located it in a liquid land. They've located it in Antarctica. They've located it in Terra. They've located it in the Sahara. Where did the Atlantic get its name? And where were the pillars of Gibraltar? Everyone, Herodotus included, agree it was at the Straits of Gibraltar. And he said, beyond that, now, did Atlantis exist in the pre-flood world? By the way, this book, you serious-minded students ought to get this book about the pre-flood canopy, The Waters Above, by Joseph C. Dillo. With that canopy, not only was the climate different, carbon-14 dating would have been different. He even has an interesting sequence on why Noah got drunk. That the removal of the canopy changed the rate of fermentation and the alcohol content, that if you made wine the same way, and he proves it pretty much mathematically. Now, frankly, I'm not necessarily wanting to justify poor old Noah. But it does seem rather strange that he got drunk so easily and so thoroughly and so quickly. And Dillo has a rather long dissertation on the fact that if he made wine the same way and drank it in the same quantity, and this was the first crop that he had after the flood, he would have been unaware. But the change in atmospheric conditions, and he works it out in mathematical formulas, would have increased the alcohol content at the same old dose would have swacked him. And the poor old boy, he just drinks her down. Now, frankly, there's nothing in the Bible that says thou shalt not drink wine. There's plenty in the Bible to suggest they did it rather regularly. Don't anybody kid you that it was unfermented wine that was used in the Passover. But poor old Noah could be excused if the same number of cups had a different alcohol factor. And man, when that good feeling hit him, or whatever feeling it was, he attacked his clothes, I guess, with a vehemence. And there he was, drunk and naked, and here comes another peeping Tom. An old ham bone. But was Atlantis under this canopy, which would have cut the sun's rays and may explain the longevity of life before the flood, too? Was he? This the territory of those ancient priests and the kingdom of Adam and his sons. And did Enoch go from here? And did angelic sons of God help him build the great pyramid in Egypt? And what's the connection between pyramids in Atlantis and pyramids in Egypt? Now, I've been on these things. I'd like to finish something for a change. What is the explanation? I've heard everything from UFOs to some power source that sunk with Atlantis. Why do the compasses go crazy? And the electronic gear go crazy. And planes disappear and ships disappear without a trace. Now that's Bermuda. We went to Azores the other night. Azores, whatever is doing this, has a different appetite. Now Azores is on the other side, off the coast of Portugal. If Atlantis was a large landmass, the Atlantic Plateau that sank beneath the sea, Azores is on the other side. But the appetite's different in the Azores. In Bermuda, ships, planes, and people disappear. In the Azores, they only seem to be interested in taking the people. And the Mary Celeste was sailing along when we left off with nobody on board but a cat. But the ship was fine. Since the beginning of this century, a number of boats without crews have been found on the 35th parallel near the Azores. But the phenomenon did not attract any great public attention. You want me to continue with this tonight? Oh, you want me to get to the ghost story? I will. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
The phenomenon, you know why I'm doing this? The phenomenon did not attract any great public attention. Now, doesn't this beat dumping on you for all your sins? But the phenomenon did not attract any great public attention until 1969, when there were 5 new cases that can be described at the very least as exaggerated coincidences. On June 30th, 1969, the British ship Maplebank discovered a 60-foot unidentified yacht floating upside down. There's nothing particularly extraordinary about this, but on July 4th, another British ship, the Cotopaxi, sighted another unidentified yacht underway with its automatic rudder in operation and no one aboard. And on the other one, upside down, no evidence anywhere of any lives. 2 days later, the Liberian ship Golar Frost found the Vagabond, a yacht belonging to the solitary sailor William Wallen. Again, there was no one aboard. On July 10th, the press devoted long articles to the discovery of the Tynemouth Electron, belonging to another solitary sailor, Donald C. Crowhurst. 5 empty yachts sighted near the Azores in 11 days in clear summer weather. No trace of the crews on any of the 5. Now, what's the explanation? Now, I have been trying to avoid getting on a subject for some time because it's been so much the territory of the nuts. Even to talk about it might make somebody think I'm in their camp. And I'm speaking of demonology. Now, when Canon Brian Green, the former rector of Birmingham, was our guest here, and you know the role that Canon Brian Green had in my own personal pilgrimage of faith, we used to argue with much fun, remember? To him, the devil was a force. He had poked fun at me because I believe the devil was a person, a living being. And I took quite literal the biblical description when Jesus said he beheld Lucifer cast down. And I take quite literal the passage in Job that says sons of God are gathering up there, and here comes old Slewfoot. Hi there, Lucifer. What do you think of Job? Let me add him. You wouldn't think much of him yourself. God, you build a shield around him. I can't get to him. Job is the most ancient of books. Christians grow up in the church and hear about Job. That's not a poetic scene. Whomever wrote that book of Job expects us to believe such a conference took place. Let me have a fling at old Job. And God let him do it. A real, not a force, a real communicative person. I've already referenced earlier tonight in one of the hours, Zechariah's vision. Joshua representing God's people as the high priest in filthy garments before God, Satan standing there to accuse. How do you interpret the scripture? No matter whether you're Christian or not. A lot of people do not consider themselves Christians, but they believe the Bible has an accurate record. When it says that when Moses died, Michael durst not rebuke Satan to his face and contested. They fought over the body of Moses. And Michael said, the Lord rebuke you. How do you read the Gospels where Satan literally had the gumption to tempt Jesus? Some hallucination? And everywhere you turn in the Gospels, from synagogues to towns along the Sea of Galilee, Jesus is confronting what are called familiar spirits, devils, demons. What are these things? Too cold, Mike. Give me a little. No, Peter can. Somebody else can do it. Somebody that knows here, you go. That knows how to run that machine before I get a frozen stiff audience. Demonology is the subject. Now, I haven't wanted to get on it, at least until I establish a certain credibility with the audience who know the kind of person I am and the way I research things when I deal with them. But you hear my oblique references many times to the fight we're in and the devil's opposition. Very few Christians understand the real enemy out there is not the sinners. Paul said it to the Ephesians. The real enemy, Satan and his forces. We're the foot soldiers caught between. There's a real warfare going on out there. I don't know what it does to your theology of God. And theology is so abstract, you can a priori just about conceive a starting point that will let you work it out your way. I don't know whether it's self-limitation or what. There's little doubt of what God's omnipotence will prevail in the end, but some purposes he seeks and wishes to work out and set times on his calendar. Keep the devil in the picture until a set time. Now, I want to deal with demonology tonight, spooky though it may sound, and I'm going to start with this Catholic demonologist and read things to you that many of you will not believe, that haven't been where I've been with witch doctors and other things.